Okay. Thank you, Chris, and thank you very much for inviting me tonight. It's been a long time. I think it was over a year ago that we talked about it initially. And it's a real pleasure to find out about your organisation. I had no idea that there were so many people and so many different groups involved in it. I set myself the task of talking about the challenges of integrating new ideas of landscape into policy. I think because that's what I'm struggling with at the moment. So it's absolutely appropriate for where we are at the moment in terms of the West Midlands National Park. So I want to talk about it in that context. Before I start, I want you to think about where you grew up. So it's quite interesting you should mention the King's Heath Park. Obviously, I don't remember very much from that time, since I was only two when we left. But think about where you grew up, and this is where I grew up, where when we moved to South Wales. And so I could tell what time of day it was by where the sun is on the horizon, by how much noise I could hear from one direction or the other. So because the whole place was like a sundial and a meteorological station, and it was how you knew what was going on. When you think about where you grew up and how much that shaped you, your values, your culture and things like that, and you engage with people in that sense, it's a really powerful way of talking about landscape. But so much of this way of understanding has been stripped out of what we know and how we operate. So what I'm trying to do through the West Midlands National Park is to bring this way of thinking back into the frame and to understand why it's so important to do so. And in terms of creating policy to support that, the more I think about, well, it's evident to me that what you really need is to have a vision to be able to drive these things forward in a way that can engage with all the different people that you need to engage with. And to create a vision, you need to understand, well, what are the issues? What do we need to have? You need to ask, what if we did it this way? You need to be able to see the bigger picture, work across the traditional boundaries, I think, that really define what we do in current practice. And to also to be brave enough to learn new things and to change and to actually realise that we can change current practices. And to work with ideas rather than going straight down to the detail or technical fixes, which is what we're seeing particularly in terms of climate change, I think. And to constantly encourage people to see the bigger picture, to see beyond the boundaries that they normally work in. A lot of what I'm talking about comes from, so talk about changing the way we think, comes from a book I wrote, which was published 10 years ago, called Overlooking the Visual. And in that book, it was really set up to say why we think we can't teach design and how we can. But what I did, without ever intending to, was to redefine theories of perception. So had I been braver when I got it published, I would have called it The Greeks Got It Wrong. But that sort of thinking, can I really do that? Can I really think that we might have got theories of perception wrong? And because it took me such a long time to work it out, it took 15 years to write the book, I actually then also went to Harvard to talk to one of the key philosophical professors of philosophy to make sure I wasn't being completely mad. But all of that really is we're not often thought to or encouraged to think about the art of the possible, not often thought to say, what if we did it that way? And it's actually quite difficult to do that. I teach design at BCU, and many of the students there, especially the really clever students, are not used to thinking beyond what they know. They can do things very well the way they've been taught, but to go beyond that is a difficult task. And to move beyond what we know and feel secure with it, it's what could be possible, to actually imagine what alternative future scenarios are in a way that will inspire others to act and think differently, I think is what creating a vision is about. And it's, if you have a vision that's convincing, this is what will, I hope, what can, it already is, impact on policy behaviours and attitudes. So This the thing that you keep in mind the entire time you're talking, so you don't get sidetracked into the details, and you can encourage people to speak differently through this way, and then hopefully it can seep through different organisations. And part of that is to have a narrative, a compelling narrative, and especially today, that will give a sense of hope and optimism to support people, not only their long-term ambitions, but that sense of pride and a sense of identity that they have with place. Or that they need to have with place, really. The other thing is, I guess, a vision doesn't just emerge from nowhere. You know, it has to, and it won't emerge, I don't think, from just drilling down into current practice. You need to look at and think strategically and think beyond. And you always have to realise it's much easier to carry on with things as they are. So this vision that you have in order to try and change policy has to be something that's robust enough to actually encourage and support people making different decisions and behaving in different ways. And I think that, especially from the work that I've done, this visioning means, as I've said, you go across silos, disciplines and practices. And actually from the book, it means that everything that I do works across the usual dichotomies and dualities that we're faced with all the time between facts and values, science and art, nature and culture, visual and verbal, emotion and intelligence, intangible, tangible. These, I think, are based on a particular idea of what perception's about. I think they are philosophical, it's a philosophical misconception to think about perception that way. And then when we depend on those all the time, it is actually really damaging for epistemology and almost every field. It's important to work with ideas and not go straight to the technical details. It's, again, difficult to do that. It's important to recognise the economic value of self-confidence and worth. And this, to go back to what I said at the beginning, it's really important to reacquaint ourselves with the materiality of the place, because we've just forgotten about where we live, what we do, other than in a very detailed sense. So that's the physical and the social and the cultural context of our lives. Just begin to think about those things in a more tangible way. And also in the work that I've been doing, it's become really important to discover landscape where you thought it couldn't be, and to engage people through telling a new story about the place. The other thing about having a vision and to influence policy is that the vision needs to engage leaders. I was told the other day, a while ago now, that you need to go to the most influential person that you know to try and get any support to be able to develop a vision. You need to get clued up. You need to develop this to articulate the need for a long-term vision that's based on knowledge and passion and commitment and expertise. And that there should be a spatial vision, not just a list of bullet points, which is the way we normally think of visions. I've seen in many authorities, actually, there's a complete lack of spatial understanding of the place. There are lists, matrix based on tables, on map. If you've got a map, you're lucky it's just with little dots with actually no spatial awareness whatsoever. And then you need to be able to present your ideas to a range of decision makers and to try and understand what their concerns are and their needs and their ambitions, and to see how you might work collectively to try and sort this out together. We've done this in a number of ways, including having conferences, which was from 2018, which had all sorts of implications, including after that we set up the West Midlands National Park Lab. And we actually have a foundation meeting in a couple of weeks' time after Christmas. TV programmes, all sorts of things, also in the press. It was sort of quite an exciting time. And as Chris has mentioned, we've also been working with Saturn. We had a conference in 2019 with our partners from Sweden and Italy, looking at a number of case studies, and the Social Farms Network is one of them. And we're looking at the Tame Valley Wetland Partnership and, of course, the National Park Accelerator as case studies from the West Midlands in the context of the West Midlands National Park that is then informing the work of these different our partners across Europe. And I think the once you have an idea, then, of course, you need to develop that, and that's to get to know about the potential of the discipline, of the vision, rather, and that means establishing a board of really key strategic thinkers that you can find, and these are the West Midlands National Lab Advisory Board, to understand things that you might not think of as being like landscape, the impact of governance, regional strategies, financial models, develop a far greater understanding of the territory so that you can understand what it is that you're talking to, try and persuade people to think about it differently, and to understand the problems in a wider geographical context, including working to deal with our international obligations, for example, working with UNESCO, to understand how these ideas might help to implement the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals for 2030. So I was talking, for example, with UNESCO last week in Kiev. Well, I wasn't in Kiev, I was here, but conference was based in Kiev, to understand how a broader vision of landscape can actually help to protect and be used as a way to inform the wider development, wider sustainable development, not just the little area of the heritage that's there, or even the little area around it, but on a much wider spatial basis. And then, of course, we need to... In our terms, you need to promote the vision regionally, nationally, internationally. We've had a whole series of workshops and exhibitions, invited lectures, conference presentations. And one of the key things that we did that was really important in actually generating far clearer regional knowledge was actually to have the students last year worked on the West Midlands National Park for their thesis projects. And we had an exhibition at the end of the year to show what it meant in more detail, still just a fairly large scale, to understand what these case studies would be. So a lot of them looked at the idea of the Central Park, and I'll show you that a bit later. But also looking at the Tame Valley Wetlands and looking at the place where four tributaries of the Tame come together in the Black Country. And I took out our students who were, it was mainly at the international students that we had, and it took us about 2 hours to find the stream, to find this particular junction, because you can't see the rivers and the streams. They've been built on, the floodplains have been built on, or tipped on, and then they've been built on. And the only way we could find this thing was by holding a phone up and holding it over a bridge, taking a photograph and saying, yes, there's a river there. So, and yet that is an extraordinary resource. Why aren't we more cognizant of this? So that was a really important thing to do. And then to obviously be responsible all the time. So this is an early project that we did. This is when it was called HS2LV, looking at the region where we had 50 regional directors and stakeholders came along, and I got them to draw maps to say, what do you want the city to be like? Do you want it to be like it is out there at the moment? What's your ideal city? And how can we change what we've got out there if we think that HS2 is running in 15, 20 years' time? How do we change it, and what might it look like? So these are some of the drawings that we had from that workshop, and these drawing workshops are something that, Chris, you are aware of, that we've done with our partners in Italy and in Sweden. It's rather challenging trying to do these workshops digitally, I have to say, but we did it. And then trying to get ideas about how we achieve it, so in groups people actually begin to identify what the key things are. And you can see there it's vision, governance, attitude, collaboration, all the sorts of things that you would imagine that people really wanted to do. So what are we going to do? So these guys are the people, they're the ones whose imagination has actually delivered the transformation of the Industrial Revolution and the whole the history of Birmingham and the West Midlands, so that it became City of 1,000 Trades, and so that from that changed the world. They were all driven by the idea of progress. So we want to say, well, so what's our idea of progress now? And I think that it's really an extraordinary time at the moment to think that we should have this West Midlands National Park that's based on a new idea of landscape. So it's an economic proposition, I'm putting it forward as an economic proposition, that brings together all the environment, citizens, businesses, NGOs and the public sector around a wide spatial vision. So it's for the whole area. And it's important because it will help us compete in the global battle for talent. It will help to support a green recovery and address climate emergency, create thriving and healthy communities and transform, the ambition is to transform the West Midlands into the healthiest region in the UK. And significantly to put quality of life and environment at the top of the political agenda. Currently 0.15% of the budget of the West Midlands Combined Authority is spent on environment. I think it should be much bigger and it should be acting as an overarching strategy through which all the other strategies are achieved. That's why it was taxing me at the weekend. It's not obviously a traditional national park because if you look outside, clearly it's not what we see isn't a traditional national park. It's not like the Peace District. And the idea is that it brings the values of the national parks to urban populations rather than expecting them to travel out to the countryside. And I was talking to Fiona Reynolds a couple of days ago, who was the director of the National Trust, and she called this the mothership. If we have a new idea about landscape, how can we, a new idea of the national parks, how are we going to make it work? So it's about transformation. It's not just about conservation and preservation, which is what the national parks are about. It's about how do we transform this area, the whole of the plateau, into something that could become, in the long term, like a national park. And so it's a way to help to guide practice on the basis that it will improve everybody's lives. We have to work with businesses as much as schools and communities. And then to take this forward, we need to bring together a host of existing strategies and projects from the water companies, the wildlife trust, housing, transport, civic societies, all sorts of things to bring together something that's more than the sum of its parts. So if you look at the problem at the moment, well, I'm sure this will be familiar to you, but this is a map of Birmingham. And what you see are a lot of roads and a lot of buildings. If you look really hard, you might see a few contours. You might see rivers, and actually not really rivers, but you might see the canals, just about to see the river Ray. But actually, we are completely preoccupied with building and getting money in. The whole economy for the last quite some time actually has been based on increasing the tax, the receipts from developments for the economy. And actually, as far as landscape's concerned, it's more or less invisible to developers, and as far as development's concerned. So this is in Ashford in Kent, when I was asked to go and have a look where the housing should go. Bearing in mind that Ashford is under considerable pressure for development. And that's when the planners were showing me all these those verges, grass skirt verges that were really damaged or not very damaged. And I had no idea why they were showing them these. Because to my mind, what I needed to know was which way did the wind blow? What were the main commercial activities of the region? What were the main commercial pressures? Where were the main educational catchments, the main agricultural products, which they didn't know. But that, I think, is what we need to know. And because we've forgotten about all those things, to think about operating spatially and visually, I think that's created huge spatial problems within the region. So in Birmingham, for example, all these pink reddish areas are, from 8 years ago when I drew this, or 8 or 9 years ago, places that I knew where there was stress within communities. And of course, it's all wrapped around the edge of the plateau where you've got the whole network of roads, the M42, A38, A47, A452. And actually those communities are dislocated north from south. That reduces employment opportunities, educational opportunities. And it also creates environmental stress through the noise pollution and air pollution, all those sorts of things. And of course HS2 is going to come around there as well. So my comments to HS2 and to Albert Bohr, because he was in charge when I did this, was we can't afford to do this again. And if HS2 is coming along there, then actually they need to know that there's an isolated and forgotten valley to the east of that area, which could be a major health resource and recreation resource, as well as a place for growing food and processing water, etc., that we could take advantage of. And the main issue, I think, is that Albert Bohr said we've put millions and millions and millions into the areas, and it hasn't improved the multiple deprivation indices at all. And so this is a sort of, this is actually the multiple deprivation indices for the area. And Birmingham's actually in, I think it's the bottom 3%, a lot of it is in the bottom 3% of the UK. So, and then of course we have an identity crisis. So the leader of Wolverhampton Council said, how am I going to encourage 600 people to come and live in Wolverhampton? Somebody else said, why would I want to live in Birmingham? It's so ugly. Coming from the Midlands is tantamount to coming from nowhere in particular. That was in The Guardian, 2014. And also, I won't name as the employer, but apparently people, senior people coming into the organisation said, well, of course, you know that you're going to have to deal with the Birmingham factor, which means that people will laugh if you say we're coming to Birmingham. So although we have made a huge improvement, there is still an identity crisis, and that's affecting our economy. And because of this habit of reducing things to the lowest common denominator, we have a silo-driven approach to development and transformation, and that's across institutions, it's professionally and it's spatially. Outmoded and simplistic financial models and growth targets and evaluations. And there's this idea that landscape is just about remediation, amelioration, buffering. That's a particular bone of contention I have with HS2. And so there's this, what we're facing, the lack of integrated thinking, a sectoral approach, and actually I think greater expense and impoverished environments and poor quality of life in many communities. But increasingly this is being recognised, and COVID has really made a difference to this, ironically. So the fact that landscape is a blind spot for many regional economic strategies is a global problem. What we want to try and do is to be the first West Midlands, the first region in the UK to put it right. And we have made progress. So we've been endorsed by the West Midlands Command Authority, by Birmingham City Council, by the Black Country Consortium, RSPB, Prince's Trust, Arts Council England, and many other regional, national and international stakeholders. And what we want to do is to work directly with the West Midlands Command Authority and with Birmingham City Council to help them to achieve their targets in the climate action plan and the design charter and Birmingham City Council's route to zero. But it's still... I was at a meeting with real estate people, which I didn't expect to go to, but there you go, I was chairing the meeting. And of course, we're supposed to be levelling up through the provision of access to nature, space to walk, clean air, better food quality, housing and development in the right place, not just where there's land that somebody wants to sell and then make a lot of money out of it. But over the last 70 years, it's still become acceptable. It has become acceptable to think that it's necessary to address quality of life issues after all the so-called major economic decisions have been taken. And I was really shocked when somebody said to us the other day, I thought, can't they see that actually it hasn't worked? We need to do things differently. And actually, when you look at it, I think that approach has, look at Birmingham. That approach, which is evidently being used for many years, has exacerbated rather than addressed matters of environmental, spatial justice, health and deprivation. It has not improved health quality, air quality. It's not created thriving communities. It's not made us resilient in order to deal with a post-Brexit world in terms of agriculture, nature and climate change. And it's not even created a sense of place. So we have to do things in a different way. And I think key to that is really bringing back that relationship that people have with the landscape so that it becomes something that's very valued. And it's not just in the urban heritage places or the places where we think that, you know, with the Aborigines and or with the First Nation people in the States, where we somehow think it's more acceptable to have that relationship with landscape. But actually in everyday landscapes, wherever they are, whether they're in Birmingham or Salford or wherever. And it's how we can talk about landscape in performative terms. So I've got a PhD student who's looking at the SDGs, and actually hardly any of them mention landscape specifically. And yet actually, if you think about all the issues to do with water, the landscape is absolutely vital in actually helping to sort these out. So we need to start to talk about how we can deal with droughts, not just over in Australia, but actually here in the UK. How we can use, and people are beginning to do that, but we need to up the ante in terms of policy to do this. Look at how we deal with making room for the river, as they've done in the Netherlands, which we talked about years ago, but people didn't take up. But these are just from a couple of years ago. We have to have a different approach. I know that we're not going to be faced with, I hope, 2 million homes for Mexico, for example, and friable cliffs, or the extraordinary explosion of housing in Addis Ababa. But we do have a housing crisis. How are we going to deal with that? How do we actually know where to put the houses based on good geographical data? How do we deal with the depletion of natural resources, which again, these are from around the world, but are actually happening here in the UK and in the West Midlands, and with the fact that we might have only 50 harvests before the soil becomes too degraded to grow crops? How do we think about food security and actually really become more self-sufficient at a local level? And of course, air quality is a real issue in terms of shortening kids' lives by half a year. And that HS2 stint to interchange station, I've been told it's still like that, even though we were given an assurance a couple of years ago that it wouldn't be like that. But I'd be very glad to know if anybody knows that it's different. And then in terms of the larger strategies that we're talking about, how are we dealing with the legacy of the Industrial Revolution? I know this is from the 50s, and there's probably not as much the game of actually throwing bricks to make it explode in some of these pits doesn't happen anymore. But there's still a huge amount of land that needs to be remediated. Have we got a remediation strategy? Are we looking at how we use remediation? Or are we just doing the same that we've been doing? We have lots of opportunities. There's the Black Country Geopark, hooray, Coventry City of Culture, Birmingham 2022, and HS2. So how can we, what we're trying to do is to capture these and to work with people to make these a big feature of the West Midlands National Park. And I found out recently some work that I did in, I should have known about it, but in 2005, we've got a pilot, which is the Black Country Urban Park. And the thing was there that I was asked to be involved in that, to create the Black Country Urban Park. And I said I would do, but not if it meant joining up all the green spaces, but if it meant thinking about the whole area as an urban park and thinking about how we can get there, then that was something that I was interested in. And they've actually been doing it. So it became a statutory plan. Black Country Urban Park became a statutory document in 2011. And they're just looking now at refreshing it, which is just fantastic. And they've applied it, for example, in terms of the Garden City. So instead of having little bits of extensions on bits of cities, they've said the whole area is a garden city. And so they, over 1,500 hectares of land in the Black Country is classified as the Garden City. And so they're using that idea, that holistic and integrated approach to develop the area. And so, in some of the things, I've been talking to the RSPB, and so one of the things I want to talk to them about, and I have mentioned it to the RSPB, is instead of having individual nature reserves, why not say the whole of the Black Country is a nature reserve? We're aiming to get there and improve all of this over a long period of time. Also, it's really important in terms of the policy to realise that it's not going to happen overnight, and there needs to be a long-term strategy. So I worked at Salford in a previous, before I came back to Birmingham, where we were told that the Salford City Quays was going to be a new water quarter for Salford. I worked for the Derelict Land Reclamation Team. Which was a laugh because there was so much derelict land, it was thought that, you know, it was a job for life. And when we were told it was going to be a new water quarter, we just thought it will never happen. But it has happened. Now it's not perfect, but it's a lot better than it was. We've The other thing that's been really compelling in terms of changing people's minds and influencing people and trying to give them the confidence is to look at national case studies. So those of you who came to the conference would have seen Michael Rodriguez-Schwartz presenting the Ruhr case study, which involves 100 single projects, 17 cities, and in a post-industrial landscape. And so these examples gave a huge confidence that we could actually achieve something of this scale if we have that long-term view and that vision of what it can be, and that it's not at all far-fetched. But we do need to change how we work. It's a good thing for the region. I think people are beginning to realise, even though it's by calling it a national park, it would have been far easier to call it a regional park. But actually, by saying it's a national park, that is really changing perceptions of the region because it is so counterintuitive. And that has great credibility because it was approved, we were applauded and supported by the Landscape Review of Parks, chaired by Julian Glover, the government report that was commissioned by Michael Gove. And the value of having a vision rather than a list is, as I've said, is new, is refreshing, it's gathering a lot of attention in government within national and international organisations. And I've been asked to go to a place in Austria, which I haven't been able to get to, because the Count there, Count Habsburg, has told me that he wants me to look at his ponds. And I've only just found out that in these ponds, I thought ponds, you know, pond means something to me that's not very big, but he's got 3 million carp. So they're obviously huge ponds that all of them are man-made, at the cusp between two major rivers that go either side of Germany. So it's quite an extraordinary project, and he wants to help us to help him to do that. So it's bringing in investment and funding in order to achieve not just the economic recovery, but cultural health and well-being and our environmental ambitions. And it's giving us the opportunity to look at different models of investment and governance, and to bring together various strategies, which is why I'm so glad to be speaking to you, because I need your help. We've got a list of projects that we've been working on, and for the summer I'm working with Dr. Robin Daniels. It's been brilliant to work with him. So the Geopark, this was actually preempted by came out of the Black Country as Urban Park project that I did in 2005. Because it was called Above, Beyond and Beneath. And of course, the geology of the Black Country is astonishing. I mean, that's why it was the crucible of the Industrial Revolution. And we've got this UNESCO inscription. I hope you all knew about it. It was actually approved in July. But my niece came up to see it and got off the train and said, "Where is it?" So there's a lot of work to be done to actually make this, you know, I know that Graham Wharton's working on this, to really make it a real prize for the region, which it is. We've also been looking at, James, you recognise this, the idea of having a Birmingham Central Park, because at the moment, when people get off HS2, they're sort of funneled into the Primark and the city centre. But actually, I think, and I've not been involved in it recently, but actually this whole area would become a bit of a cul-de-sac, hemmed in between the Lorley Ringway, the railway viaducts, and the east side and Digbeth become even more dislocated from the rest of the city. So I'm suggesting that we go underneath the railway viaducts, take in the various historic buildings that are there, listed buildings there, and have a major park that would be a real welcome to Birmingham. And that sort of helped to inform the major ring parks project that we put forward to the West Midlands Combined Authority and to Birmingham City Council, so that this is actually looking at the region in a way that doesn't prioritise the roads, but actually indicates, perhaps a bit timidly at the moment, in purple the canal system, in blue the river system. And that led to this project where I realised that there's a whole network of called the Edwardian Fringe Belt, you might all know about that, so at the end of the First World War, the building of Birmingham stopped, And then when it started again, you've got these remnants, sort of these green ovals that are sort of left embedded within the city, and development carried on the other side of them. So we've got an Edwardian fringe belt. If you think the red dot in the middle is the idea of having Birmingham Central Park. The red circle there is the canal ring that wasn't completed around Birmingham, and I'm not suggesting that we do complete it because that obviously would be phenomenally expensive, but at least to connect it round. That's the pink line, sorry. The red line is the inner ring road, which is going to be decommissioned, and so that should be a whole series of parks and squares rather than just a scaled down road. And then we have the green area around, the green circle around there is the Middle Ring Road, which also, I think that's going to be taking most of the traffic, or any of the traffic that's diverted from the centre of Birmingham. But if that's going to be repurposed, then it needs to include cycle paths and footpaths that are well designed, not just little painted lines on the road. And then the pink lines on here are the canal system, other canals. And the blue lines are the rivers. And so wherever these intersect, these should be the locusts for the places where we begin development, not near to a major motorway junction, as I think is at the moment, or next to a main road, but actually where people can walk and cycle to work, so they increase health and well-being and biodiversity and all sorts of things like that. So, and then that led to the idea, since we're looking, that actually, if we did that in Birmingham, we could also do that across the whole of the West Midlands Combined Authority. So we could have a city centre park in Coventry, in Solihull, in Birmingham, Walsall, Wolverhampton, so that all of these places actually have a similar, these could compete, they could be connected by cross-regional footpaths that connect through the canal systems and along the rivers where possible, through the urban areas where some roads would then become for cyclists and pedestrians only, so we don't just have to depend on the space structure that we have. So that we begin to have this whole network of cycling routes across the region, connecting into the ring parks, the canals and the rivers, that we become a region of 1,000 parks and squares. Imagine arriving into Birmingham New Street or at Curzon Street to know that you could travel around through parks and squares. That we really do celebrate the industrial heritage, including this amazing bridge at Bolton Bridge. And that we, instead of having this rather, I can't even think of the best way of describing it, sorry state of affairs on the left-hand side, which are the rivers, why don't we become a region, we move from this region of invisible and neglected rivers to a region of 1,000 lakes and streams. And that's something that school kids everywhere can get involved in, that we should think seriously about reclaiming the floodplains. There's already 400 kilometres of water courses in Birmingham, but most of them you can't see. And that involves water purification. And I don't mean little ditches for sustainable urban drainages, but big, substantive systems that actually can replenish the water, so that we can begin to pump up water from the aquifer that's already that is so polluted, purify it, send it through the Tame, and then put it back into the aquifer, so that we actually begin to replenish our systems, and contribute to health strategies by prioritising cyclists and pedestrians over cars. The business case is really important. We're trying to work with hoping to work with Kate Raworth and various other people from Birmingham University to look at how we can actually really develop a robust business case, because a lot of people have been working on this, so there's a lot of information about it. So that to know that actually when you have a good quality environment, that's what attracts people coming in, that's what attracts global talent. So this area at the bottom was San Cugat de Val in Barcelona, where the park was put in first and then the housing brought in, and it became the fastest growing area in Catalonia very quickly. How do we change the mindsets and these working practices? How do we count the cost of outdated 19th and 20th century practices and the degrading impact that has on health and quality of life? And how do we then value the benefits of taking a more holistic approach? And actually, when you think about the High Line in New York, the amount of money that that has brought in and the impact that that has, perhaps we don't want it to be that significant, but it nonetheless has become a place that people want to come to visit, and that can't be a bad thing. And the governance issue, I mean, everybody will say, well, yes, we do collaborate, but actually what they're doing is just sort of muscling each other out of the way rather than actually sharing the risks, sharing the costs, and sharing the benefits of actually working properly together as a proper collaboration to get the best solutions spatially, visually, and economically for the whole city, not just working to their own individual solutions. And so I think that's how we can begin to, if we do that, that's what we're working on at the moment with the West Midlands Grand Authority, with the New City Council and the Black Country Consortium, to see how these ideas can inform the Climate Action Plan, Green Recovery Plan, policy at Dudley and Wolverhampton, and how we can contribute to the new Birmingham's Big City Park, Big City Plan, however it's going to be called, and their Route to Zero. And one of the key things to do is to encourage a development scheme through the West Midlands National Park Awards and accreditation, which we're working on at the moment. So we're hoping that it's going to shape things. I hope, you know, that we've begun to make these policy steps that I've been describing, but actually, you know, and we're just carrying on with this, pushing on with it to make sure that we become, that actually what we get is that West Midlands will have an advantage that comes with the territory rather than it being a disadvantage, that we can build cultural identity because people really want it. The number of people who really want to have that sense of pride, who feel fed up that we're always put down and have that negative identity. And also, of course, so that this can encourage work across silos. So, and as Julian Glover said, it's already getting people to think and act differently. So, as I've said, we're working on the accreditation, the awards criteria. We are really wanting to work with groups like yourselves to identify what projects could be brought into the West Midlands National Park, so we can build, say, you know, it's already happening, these are the things that are going on, how we can build up knowledge of the region. I still don't have access to wildlife data. We need cultural maps for the regions. We need traditional land. I want to know where we have traditional land-based skills. I'm a director of the International Traditional Knowledge Institute for the UK because I'm really interested in traditional land-based skills and new land-based skills. Where are they? What sort of things are there? And how can we learn from them? And then many other questions. Where can we save and cleanse water? There's a lot of other things to go on. And actually, a key thing really is, I think, is this relationship between the physical, material and environmental policies of the region and deprivation and the spread of COVID. So, to sum up, we want to be a healthier place. We hope that West Midlands National Park can contribute to that, so people will want to come and live here. We want to work with you and groups like you to help to make it a reality. We've got the lab. We undertake research. We inform and promote policy development. And our system collecting the lab's data to analyse data of relevance to the West Midlands National Park and also to advise on commercial and market-led commercial activity. The advisory board is made up of these people and we have the foundation is going to be in the new year, and we're working with a whole lot of people nationally. So that's what we can do. New way of thinking, new way of working, help to support development of policies, work streams and strategies across the region, and to understand how the ethos of the West Midlands National Park can be integrated into plans and strategies, which I think is a really important way of moving forward. So we've already started, but we very much look forward to working with you. Okay, Chris, is that okay?
Catherine, thanks very much. That's excellent. And 1 minute shy of 45 minutes, which is almost bang on the nail for time as well.
Thank you.
So thank you very much. We've got a couple of questions in the chat. I'm just going to bring up.
Hang on, I need to find out how I get back to this.
So.
Oh, I need to stop sharing, don't I? Ah, there you go.
There we go.
So we've got 18 questions.
There we
Which
are.
One, what do you want me to answer?
I've got it where I wanted it. So if we start with a couple that seem to be related around planning, and I know you're an architect, not a planner, but hopefully you'll have a take on these. So Judith asks how this ties in with the white paper on new planning regulations. And Graham asked in a linked question that Robert Jenrick currently wants to change the planning regulations, as many of us know, and whether you feel that's a good change and how that might affect things. So two interlinked questions on planning to start with.
Okay, sorry. Well, I've responded to the planning review. And there, well, I think it's going to take quite a bit of time before it gets through, isn't it? The idea of zoning, I think, is a bit strange. But I think that also it sort of misses that connection of people to their environment. And that's the main thing that I would say about it. It's not a flat piece of land. It's not a no place. It's a place where people live and they have that sense of belonging or they need that sense of belonging. And how do we work to get that? So those are some of the comments that I've made. And also I just don't know that design guides will do it, because I've seen so many design guides and I've seen so many places that have been design guided into existence that are absolutely awful. I was at a conference in the southwest, I think it was. No, southeast. And this planner put up all these images about the housing estate that had been done absolutely informed by this design guide. And somebody voiced what we were all thinking after about 5 minutes, said, are these supposed to be good examples or bad examples? And I think when you have something that's like, it's just not the right way of doing it. And then the housing audit thing, report that came out from the Bartlett, you know, it just shows how poor the housing quality is across the UK. Now, I don't know that that's a planning regulation issue. Well, it is in many respects, but hammering the planning system or changing it or whatever isn't going to be the only way to deal with that. It needs this different attitude. I think.
Thank you. Graham, do you want to add anything to that since you asked the question, or Judith? Graham.
Just to say, I agree with the professor entirely. And Birmingham's not without issues in this area. We have a golf course that's currently going to be built on, despite much local protest. And Dudley, you mentioned in your discussions, they're actually building on the bottom of the Clent Hills. It doesn't seem very green to me. The message clearly isn't getting through yet. Thank you, Chris.
No, thank you, Graham. Judith, would you ask one of those questions in there? Is there anything you'd like to add?
Just switch my microphone on, yes. I just happened to be at a planning meeting discussion about the new white paper this afternoon, and I've been involved a little bit with Victoria Tower Gardens in London, where a park is basically going to be potentially destroyed by government policy. There's a big consultation going on, a public hearing, but I don't think that the government listens to what we've got to say. And it just bothers me that whatever we feel is a good way forward, it's in the hands of the government, and what in a democratic society, we still don't have much right to have our voice heard. They just trample on us. And I don't know what, you know, as people in the community, what can we do about it? As Catherine said, you know, having regulations is one thing, but they're not good regulations. It's not going to take us forward, is it?
No, we just have to get loud and noisy.
Okay, right. I'll join you there.
Well, you know, I think so. Like, I was thinking the other day, why do I keep doing scary things? I do. I keep doing such scary things. And I just think, well, it's because I want to change things. I know that somebody will say, turn around to me, like this restaurant is not true. Well, I do. I know that somebody might turn around and say, Catherine, you've had enough. Just go away. Forget it. I'm prepared for that. But until that happens, I'm not going to be. And I'm going to make as much noise about it as I can and challenge people. And I think we all should do that. I don't mean to be vigilant, you know, but, you know, in the most effective way that you can, which is why I said about the visioning thing, because that's been so powerful. And it's been so interesting to see how many people can't think strategically. You know, they can only think looking down and sort of moving the deck chairs around, if you like, rather than actually thinking, now, what is the real problem here and how can we do this? And we need to have a debate about at that scale. I remember when the first meeting I went to with HS2, when it was first proposed, there was a big meeting at BCU and it was chaired by Evan Davis. And it was at the stage when, Evan, it had just been announced and there must have been, I think, 250 people in the auditorium there. Two women, me and one of the deputy vice chancellor, and they were all talking about, well, how many stops are going to be and how much of the tickets and where are we going to, why isn't it here and it's not there? And it was all, what's the timetable and how many, you know, all that sort of detail level. So in the end, I picked up, I caught his eye and I asked him about thinking about it at this larger scale. You know, we could think about it as the biggest project that's going to come thundering along the country and impacting on communities left, right and centre. How do we make the most of that? And it was the first time they'd had a discussion about, rather than let's stop it, it was like, if it is happening, how do we make it work? And so he and I had this amazing conversation right at the end of this to try and think about, given, you know, just change the conversation really. And I think that's really important. Because actually, sorry, I'm taking
nope. over.
But the other thing is that I know that nearly every profession thinks they have the answer to climate change or to the issue of global challenges that we have, from computer scientists to whatever region, any discipline or idea, they all think that they can do that. And perhaps they can all contribute to it. But what we have to do is work out a way of bringing these things together and to actually have a conversation that isn't the same as all the other conversations that are going on. And that requires, I think, a much more strategic view.
Thank you. And Penny, I'll come back to you in a moment because I know you've got a question on there. But still linked to the sort of planning related questions, and this is from James, who, as you know, is very closely connected with the City Park for Brum campaign. So with initiatives such as the Brownfield First policy of the West Midlands Combined Authority for new developments, will it really be possible for green space to be an important part of city centre developments across the West Midlands, relating to your circles in the different urban centres?
Well, actually, when I first had that idea, okay, it's two things. One, I said to Abby Street, I've had a bit of an idea. And he went, he said, oh, your ideas are usually brilliant, but very expensive. And then I presented it to, some of the other officers that, you know, Jackie and Ed Cox, and she said, you know, I think this is just the sort of radical thing that people really want at the moment. So, yes, I think there will be. And actually, I think it's going to take time, and we're in such uncertain times now. How do we can't tell anything, can we? It's also difficult, except that there needs to be something that is actually going to elevate aspirations and create jobs, and this could be one way of doing this. It's not a shovel-ready project. It's not talking about planting millions of trees, but it is a way of energising a regional movement to try and create something that's different. And the power of that is incredible. It is really important. So I am hopeful of this, yes. And so they want it to be Project One. That's why we put it forward.
James, any comment?
The other thing, though, that's interesting, in terms of brownfield development, I think that from what I can see, that I know there's a lot more brownfield land in China than there is in the rest of the world, but they are really driving ahead in terms of phytoremediation and a different approach. And I'm really interested in how we, if it is possible, to look at a different way of dealing with it rather than the traditional way that we were looking at a long time ago in Salford.
Thank you. James, any additional comment?
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, thanks, Catherine. Lovely to hear your talk. It's, again, very inspirational. It was just really to follow up on that, because I think politically, I mean, building on Greenbelt land is frowned upon and for all the right reasons, but it's just where the new housing developments are. I just feel like, the poorer communities in the city centres, you think, here's a brownfield site, let's just put all the new housing there. And I think it's just changing that mindset and perhaps a bit more nuance in terms of thinking about Greenbelt land and also thinking about the brownfield sites. I mean, with the City Park for Brum campaign, we say brownfield to greenfield. And I just feel like we need to, this integrated approach that you're promoting, I want to be optimistic that the people who make those decisions will listen to that. So all communities are invested in with green space. Well, and network green space.
I was having a conversation, I won't say who it was with, somebody very senior, one of the big local authorities, and I was talking, and I was just thinking, I was looking at him, God, somebody's letting outside of his box. And he looked at me and he said, Catherine, I've been let out of my box. It's just amazing. So I think there is a really new... There is an energy for a different approach. The forces of resistance against it are huge and significant, and I do not underestimate them at all. But I think we have something that can help to make a difference here. I really do.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both. And again, the word planning is in this one. I will come back to you, Penny, in a minute, I promise. David Gumpertz, which is a comment as much as a question, that the Wildlife Trust, as we know, have been working on the landscape level conservation for many years. They try to see ecological units that can be linked by wildlife corridors. The ecological planning doesn't seem very prominent in the vision.
No, absolutely right. And not because it isn't, but actually, if you think about the reason why I'm not, I'm a landscape architect. I've spent all of my life creating better landscapes, including significant amounts of time creating different ecological habitats, woodland management, all that sort of stuff. And of course it's important, but I want to get away from the fact that that's seen as being, as I said at the beginning, something that is tacked on after everything else has happened. And I think that it's very easy to dismiss as something, it's the soft stuff that happens after the major developments have happened. And that's why I'm talking about this as an economic proposal. Because if we just talk about it as ecology, then you'll get people who are sympathetic to that, but there's no economic clout to it yet. And we need to change minds in a different way by talking about the economics of thinking about the, of having a different approach to development. And of course, I saw my garden. It's like a woodland. It is a woodland. Too many trees out there. But if I start talking about, I am talking about ecological mapping and all that sort of stuff. But this won't happen just by creating more ecological habitats. It's an important part of it, but it's not the whole thing. And I want to be able to articulate the whole thing so that everybody, the people with the power, with the money, with the capacity to deliver, become engaged in it in a very significant and substantive way.
Thank David, you. Would you like to come add anything to that, or...?
No, I quite understand where it's coming from. It's just, it felt there was a bit of a hole there somewhere. So I've spent 15 years working as a volunteer and a trustee of the Wildlife Trust. I've obviously got a slightly different perspective. It's not, neither perspective is right or wrong. I just wanted to make sure that the greeny things got a bit of a outing today.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. It's the heart of it.
So, finally, Penny. Penny put a comment in there and a question, and I think again, this relates to the urban centres and the circles that you showed on your slide. Nod if that's right, Penny. Yes. Yes. So Penny has a friend in London who sees that they see London as a series of villages. And is this where that what part of that vision, what that is part of a vision of? And this reminds me of the healthy villages work that happened, or healthy villages that happened in the West Midlands a few years ago, and certainly very much around health and urban landscape, that seeing things as a series of villages. And is that how that developed? Is that the right sort of question, Penny?
Yeah, I have a friend I met the other day. I hadn't seen him for a couple of years, and he now works in Haringey in the week. And for me, as an outsider, I just see the vastness of London. And I asked him how different London was to Birmingham, and he just said, I just see it as a series of villages, which I thought was really fascinating, because sometimes when it takes you an hour to cross Birmingham, you can really feel that you're kind of dislocated and apart from different parts of your own city. Does that make sense?
Well, that's how I see Birmingham anyway. I mean, my husband was born and bred in Harborne, which is where I am now. And somebody from Harborne saw him in Moseley. What are you doing over here? It's like, why are you there? Why have you come to Moseley? And I'm sure it happens vice versa, and the same with all the other places that are around. But I think, and yes, is the answer. But you have to be careful, because when I did that work in the Black Country, in the 2003 or 2005, it was very clear that we couldn't call it the Endless Village. I think it's called the Endless Village. There's a big study done talking about how all these different villages were there, and they didn't want to have that description. Now, I think what's happened now, because of COVID and because of this whole idea that people, or that the whole change in mood, that people, in as a necessity, have become more local in the way that they shop, in the way that they work, and they're working at home, and they see what's outside, and they go for walks in their parks, they've got them near, or whatever. I think that really reinforces this idea of a series of villages. And I think that, I mean, I thought that initially when I first came back here that the ring, that inner ring road is actually the reason why the urban villages were so strong in Birmingham was actually because of that ring road. Because you, unless you really knew how, you couldn't get into the city centre. You had to know how to, you couldn't just happen upon it. You were just flung around and out the other end. And so there's also that relationship between the city centre and these other places, like all of the villages of this conurbation who that have developed perhaps more than other places would have done. So I think it is that actually like that. But how much that becomes part of the narrative, I don't know. Because it was politically sensitive a while ago.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that's all the typed questions in the chat. I'm going to throw it open for a couple more if anybody has any live questions they'd like to ask. Chris Vaughan.
Thank you, Chris. Kathy, thank you very much for an inspirational and transformational talk. I chair Friends of Edgbaston Reservoir, and we were lucky enough to have the council proposed an SDP for the reservoir that's brought the thousands of houses that are going to be built around here to profit from the new rail line. What happened was that's fine, but they brought housing inside the reservoir. And so what we did is we produced our own SDP. And now we're in dialogue with the council to write a new SDP. I noticed in your talk that you said you had a doctoral student who is looking at the supplementary planning documents. I wondered if you could link me up with him.
No, she's looking at the sustainable development goals, not planning documents.
All right. I thought you said SDP.
SDP. Sorry. That's my enunciation.
Oh, but that's not the case.
No, it's not. I've seen the plans for one of my neighbours showed them to me, and it looks really, it'd be really interesting to see what you're going to do with that.
Yeah. I mean, I can send you our document if you like, if that would be of interest.
No, it would. Of course, it's just over there.
Well, yeah, that's right. And it's not an Edwardian site, nor is it a Victorian site. It is a Georgian site with probably the only medieval landscape in Birmingham. But so we did reimagine, as you said, what the reservoir should look like, rather than the trickle-down economic background that the council always has. Put housing in the reservoir to pay for the reservoir. So,
do you mean drain the reservoir?
No. Sorry, there's a site there, the Tower Ballroom site.
Oh, the ballroom site. Yeah, I know.
So they're going to put lots of houses in there, which will then impinge on everybody's freedom. I would think if private householders are going to come in and dictate how the reservoir is run, that is our fear. But so we're talking at the moment.
Well, I'd be very interested to know how you get on. Oh yeah, I'd love to see them. Yeah.
But thank you for the talk. It's really, really inspirational. Thank you.
Thank you for that one, Chris. Caroline, did I see your hand raised?
Yes, Catherine, that was terrific. I felt like I could have spent, you know, half an hour on each slide trying to understand the whole breadth of your knowledge and understanding of, and it was a whole other way of looking at Birmingham, which, I'm overwhelmed by it. It was so interesting. Is it possible to have access to the slides? Where can I get your book? And what can we do to because this is something about rethinking our city and the amount of money which has been wasted over the years in trying to deal with stuff which, if it had been thought about in a different way, we could have had a much lovelier city to live in. So thank you very much. That's terrific.
Well,
thank you, Caroline. Thank you.
I mean, I, at the moment, in terms of, well, that's very kind of you to say that. That's great. Thank you. I agree that it could have been done differently. Some friends came over, colleagues came over from Munich, and they spent a day in the city before they came to VCU. When they walked in, this woman just looked at me and said, why is Birmingham so rude in its planning? You just need a different approach. In terms of how we can work together, perhaps we need to have a conversation with Chris about this and what we could do together and how we can generate interest and network and, I don't know, there are many things that need to be, raise awareness of it, help to, we're talking to loads of different people at the moment to look at how we can build projects with them, get funding in to support the development of the projects, get funding in to help support the employment of people to do different tasks like the geopark and that sort of thing. So perhaps that we should have a different conversation about this at some point.
Excellent. Are there any more? Baden.
Hello, Cathy. Very interesting talk. I was pleased to see George Cadbury there, or St. George, as I think you might describe him. I don't know, but he seemed to me to be, not the personification, but certainly illustrated in his ideas about the area of southwest Birmingham. The notion of place and integration, and one doesn't have to travel a long way to work, but one can get to work through parks, rural scenes, and his bringing, as it were, the environment into his housing. I mean, the Bourneville Village Trust still, I think, have this policy of every garden must have so many fruit trees, etc. I'm secretary of the Licky Hills Society, which we've always seen, historically speaking, as George Cadbury creating his own green belt, as it were, or his barrier to the development of Greater Birmingham. And we see ourselves, if this isn't a presumptuous thing to say, as continuing his legacy. I mean, interesting thing about your talk, that there was just that one shot I saw, and the Licky Hills Society was in, I think it was the Purple Ring Regional Parks. The thing about the Licky Hills Country Park was it actually brought the city into the what was described at the time as rugged countryside, although with fewer trees then. I'm sorry, this isn't a question, it's a kind of comment and commentary really, and one may come out of it. But recently, I'm not sure, Cathy, if you've heard about the notion of the, for want of a better word, the West Midlands Regional Park. I think it's just called the Regional Park.
Hills.
Pardon?
The Eight Hills Regional Park.
Stretching from
around the south.
Hagley, around the west and south. And round to, Weatheroak, Withall. And it's very much green corridors, landscape, etc. For want of a better way of putting this, I suppose I detect a certain amount of suspicion in some areas that it seems to be skirting round Birmingham and into the areas of that Birmingham might expand into. I suppose you know that Birmingham is one of the biggest landowners in North Worcestershire, if not Worcestershire itself. I was really asking you to comment on how this, if you like, L-shaped regional park might link up with your ideas.
Yeah, I think I've had discussions with the National Trust about this because they are putting together this proposal. Mm-hmm. And I see it as being part of, it would be a really important component of the West Midlands National Park. I haven't looked at it in detail, but certainly I've been talking to Andy Beer, who's the main, the regional guy from the National Trust, for quite, you know, for three years or so, around the what it might mean in terms of the West Midlands National Park, and then latterly how the regional park might fit in with that. There is a lot of suspicion around though, isn't there? About
yes.
I mean, somebody wrote to me saying that it was, West Midlands National Park was just an excuse to build lots of houses on greenfield land. And I just thought, well, I don't know where that idea's come from. Other than, I just, nothing that I've said would, you know, it's not part of it at all.
And then the other issue is getting people to this regional park, because the transport connections are, I suppose, to the Lickey Hills, the best one is the railway, but of course we had the urban railway, we had a tram network that carried people. You could get to Kinver, for instance, through urban rail, well, tramways. there's no question that it's...
thank you very much, Baden, and certainly the Eight Hills Regional Park was something I've come across as well. So it's really interesting that all these opportunities are potentially linking together. But also that question about trust and what lies beneath, I think is a good way to describe it. And certainly as you know, reflecting on some of the Future Parks, program conversations, one of the challenges that come up there very often is, well, you know, how do we know what's really happening? How do we move away from the expectation that the council will do everything? And how do we move towards that place where actually we're all taking more ownership and more responsibility for our own, patches of land? And, I was given a link by the tree people actually this morning on a call, about green space stewardship. And it's a US website. Which is about not ownership, but engagement and care, of green spaces. And, that's something that's certainly worthy of quite a bit more, investigation. And I think, Sarah, we can perhaps send the link out to that at some point as well from that call this morning. Anyway, sorry, was there a, no. That's all right. It's 7 minutes to 8. Wow. Thank you. Can I, before I hand back to Sarah, just on behalf of the Open Spaces Forum, thank Catherine very much for her time this evening, and her time in putting what's been a really interesting and thought provoking, lecture together. So thank you very much, Catherine, on behalf of Birmingham Open Spaces Forum. And I think a round of online applause will go down very well.
Thank you very much.
Before we wrap up, I'm going to hand back to Sarah. Oh, sorry. You've beaten her to it. I'm going to hand back to Sarah to do all the wrapping up and admin. But thank you, as I say to Catherine, but thank you also to everybody who's joined us this evening. For a first online lecture event from the Open Spaces Forum, apart from the coffee mornings and the coffee evenings, I think thank you very much. And it's been a good success. So Sarah, back to you.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Chris, for hosting us tonight. And Catherine, thank you. That was absolutely fascinating. I definitely would like to tie up with you again at some point so we can have a chat about how we at Birmingham Open Spaces Forum and all our groups can work in partnership with you.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, more conversations would be brilliant. So we can get back together in the new year and have a chat.
Okay, that's great. Thank you.
Brilliant. So everybody, thank you very much for coming tonight. We won't be getting out any more newsletters, I don't think, before Christmas, because I'm not around very much, but we'll be back up and running again in the new year. I'll be organising a coffee morning and a Birmingham Spaces Forum tea time for January. So please watch the links, and come and join in and just be part of the discussions. Catherine, just let me know if you want to come and get our newsletters. I'll add you to our list.
Thank you very much.
It would be lovely if we could have a photo, if people who want to be on the photo want to put their cameras on and wave, and then Matt can do a screenshot. So if everybody's happy with that, if you're not, you can leave the cameras off. It's not a problem.
Do I put the camera on, Sarah?
You're looking brilliant, darling. You're absolutely looking lovely. Right. Everybody want to wave and look happy and say, Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
Did we get a good screenshot, Matt? Brilliant. Thank you very much. So we don't have time for just a minute, unfortunately, as we have taken up the whole time. It's been absolutely brilliant. Thank you again, Catherine.
Thank you.
I would just like to wish you all a very happy Christmas, and hopefully we can have a better new year and get back to being active again next year is what we can all hope. So please stay in touch. I'll be keeping a look on my emails all over Christmas. So please stay in touch, everybody. And I look forward to seeing everybody soon. Thank you very much indeed, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye, everybody. Thank you. Bye-bye.